So first we studied the second quantization, and in the second quantization we saw that the wave function of a many-body system becomes an operator. And so this is an example of a quantum field. So it's an operator which depends on position in space. Next we studied another problem where we will see that the final answer will be some sort of quantum field theory, is the problem of lattice vibrations. So we started with a model of atoms. That are interacting with each other pairwise, so that the interaction potential has a minimum distance A, which means that in the equilibrium they will form a regular array where the distance between atoms will be equal to A. And then they will oscillate near the equilibrium positions. So let's describe these oscillations. And okay, so to that we write the coordinate of the atom as equilibrium position plus the displacement. Usually this is called the displacement vector. Because in three dimensions, in position of atom and lattice is described by a vector. So here, vector is one dimension. And the Hamiltonian for that is written down in terms of the displacement vectors and expanded to the quadratic order in U has this form. So this is already an approximate expression where we neglected higher orders of the displacement vectors, because we assume that they are very small. And now we are going to make another approximation. Namely, we will assume that the oscillations that we study are slowly varying along the chain. So we assume that the distance, so the difference between, say, nearest neighbor displacement is much smaller than the displacement themselves. So the increment of the displacement when we go from one atom to another is very, very small. So this we can picture in the following way. So we have, if we plot displacements as functions of n, they will group into in such a way that we can approximate their positions by a continuous curve, right? So since they not jump too much relative to their neighbors, then they are somehow approximated by a continuous function. So we can introduce interpolating function u of x such that un is okay. It's convenient to to introduce some rescaling. And also we can introduce an interpolating function for p. All of these factors of all the square roots are just useful for nicer normalization of formulas. So, and then what do we do next? So here you see that this difference is very small, and so we can just replace it by a derivative. So un plus 1 minus un is approximately a times square root of a over m times the derivative of this interpolating function. Then the sum can be replaced by an integral. And finally, we get the Hamiltonian in the form of an integral of some functions, square root of x . So because I did all these rescalings, you see that all the constants disappear and we only have this CS squared that I introduced the other day in front of this derivative term in the Hamiltonian. Now, what is the meaning of this Hamiltonian? Well, it depends on what we have started with. So we could have started with a classical problem. Namely, we could have thought that this is just a Hamiltonian of dynamical system with such and such number of variables, and then we do these approximations. So in that case, since u, n, and pn were canonical variables, such will be functions p and u. So in this case, we can treat this as a Hamiltonian system, but with infinite number of degrees of freedom. So then P of X and U of X are canonical variables. And we can go on and derive the equations of motion that describe say, time dependence of U and P. On the other hand, we could have started with the quantum problem. So in which case, U, N, and P, N were operators that commuted on H bar, if N's are the same. And if you trace back all normalizations, you can figure out that the commutation relations of interpolating functions u of x and p of y is normalized to the delta function, which basically replaces the Kronecker delta in the commutator of un and pm. Okay, so then in that case, we are dealing with quantum field theory because we have operators that depend on position, so they're operator-valued functions, and the Hamiltonian is a function, it depends in some way on this operator. So knowing the commutation relations, we can try to diagonalize this Hamiltonian. So we'll do both of these calculations. Let us start with the classical theory. So in classical theory, well, we need to write down the canonical equations of motion, which are, let's see, dp over dt is minus dh over du, and du over dt is plus dh over dp. Right? So these are the Hamiltonian equations for any system. But now, what do we mean by derivatives here? Because u and p are now functions themselves, so we need to understand how to differentiate the object that is a function of a function. So such objects are called functionals, and they appear all over the place in quantum field theory. So let me spend some time explaining what is a derivative of a functional. So suppose you have some functional of a function. So to stress that this is that v itself is a function, sometimes it's the argument of a functional is written in square brackets. This is the usual notation. Okay. So the ordinary partial derivative of a function. So this can be compared with, say, function of n variables. Now, if you have function of n variables, then the derivative is defined by a linear linear increment of this function. So if we add a small increment to its argument, then the function will change linearly, and the coefficients are partial derivatives of the function. Right? So this is, you can, thank you. You can think that this is a definition of partial derivative. So if you have a functional, the definition is absolutely the same. So we take an argument. Add to it a little increment. And expand to the linear order in delta v. So this would give, this will give, well, now it will be an integral. So it will be linear in delta v. And the coefficient will be some function of x, which we, by definition, call the variational derivative of the functional in v. So this is, you wish this is, if you wish, this is a definition. But this shows, I mean, this is a constructive definition. So once you have a function, you just take a linear variation of its argument, expand, and rid of the coefficients in the resulting integral. Okay, as an example, we can take this Hamiltonian. And compute, so it depends on two functions. So we can compute two functional derivatives, and one in P and one in U. And okay, so then we just write that V of P plus delta P, U plus delta U is an integral of dx P plus delta P squared plus CS squared du over dx plus d delta u over dx squared. So then we expand to the linear order, okay, then we get the unperturbed functional plus the integral of 2 so here is 1/2. Sorry, here was in this formula there was an error 1/2. So here also better write a 1/2. And then so we'll have a 2 from expanding the bracket here. Also we'll have du over dx also with a 2. And then d delta u over dx. So the first term has the desired form, right? So it's linear and delta p. But the second term is not. So to bring it to the right form, we need to differentiate by integrate by parts. Okay, so from this expression, we can read off what are the functional derivatives of this Hamiltonian. So then delta H over delta P is P, and delta H over delta U is, minus CS squared D2 u over dx squared. And this is, just the way how you compute the functional derivatives. Yes?
So in your formula for the functional derivative, you have it defined with the, over there with an integral.
Yes.
But the Hamiltonian already has an integral in it, so somehow I was expecting there to be two integrals dx.
So functional is, so it's a black box. It may have integral or many integrals.
Right.
It's just something that you give me V, I give you F of it. So this can have an integral in it or
right, if I take integral dx of the function that is the Hamiltonian dx, etc. And the functional itself has an integral dx in it. There should be integral dx.
Okay, maybe let's do another exercise and perhaps it will become clearer. So let's say that the functional of v of x is v of 0. Right? So then what is the functional derivative of this function? So delta f is equal to delta v of 0. And this doesn't seem to have an integral. But we can write it as an integral dx delta v of x times delta function of x. Right? So delta function makes it to localizes the integral of 0. So therefore, delta f over delta v of x is equal to delta of x. So more general result is that delta v of y over delta v of x is equal to delta of y minus x by the same sort of argument. So functional can be anything. So if it's a double integral, then the functional derivative will itself contain an integral. So this is this formula is general. You cannot get anything else. Like this formula is general. We always have a sum of linear increments with some coefficients, which are derivatives. Okay, so returning to our problem, let me say that one can also generalize integral calculus to functionals. So functional integral plays an extremely important role in quantum field theory. And you'll hear a lot of it in the second part of the course. So, because somehow it's a little bit more difficult to, it's more difficult formalism. So now we can write down the equations, the Hamiltonian equations for this Hamiltonian, which are so the equations are du over dt is equal to p, and dp over dt equals to minus cs squared d to u over dx squared. From which we can exclude p by differentiating the first equation mt and then expressing the time derivative from the second equation. So we can write it as a single equation for u. Actually, I made the mistake in the sign here, because dp over dt is minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian. So here is another minus, so here will be plus. And hence, the equation will be with a minus. Which is the should be very familiar to you. This is just a wave equation. Yes.
Earlier, when you wrote the canonical equation of motion, you used partial derivatives.
Yes.
Over there, on the top line, you used the variational derivative. Is there some different reason for that? I mean, are they the same in this case? So
well, they just replace partial derivatives when they deal with
functionals.
Functionals. So the Hamiltonian is. If you're doing in field theory, so the rule of thumb is following. So partial derivatives are replaced by variational derivatives. Sums are replaced by integrals. And that's it. So arguments are replaced by functions. So OK, so this equation describes waves, and these are nothing but sonic waves propagating through this one-dimensional crystal. So they just describe sound waves. Of the vibrations of atoms are is nothing but sound. So this constant C of s is the speed of sound. And it was determined by the curvature of the potential in its minimum, so that the larger is the curvature, the faster the sound will propagate. Should we start it with three-dimensional problem? This equation will have will be basically the same. right? Because sound is always described by the wave equation. The only important difference will be that the displacement will be a vector, so sound waves will have three polarizations, so the two transverse and one longitudinal. Now let us study the quantum problem. And physically the quantum problem means that we want to quantize sound waves. So in quantum theory, we should treat this P and U as operators. And then we would like to diagonalize the Hamiltonian to find the set of energy levels, etc., etc. So for the lack of time, I will not present the logic behind the derivation, but we'll just write down the answer. And one of the problems for tutorials is to check that this is indeed the correct answer. So let's introduce operators A and its conjugate by basically Fourier transforming U and P. And then the Hermitian conjugate is, just take Hermitian conjugates of all operators, but U and P are Hermitian. So you change I to minus I everywhere, and this gives the A Degger operator. As notations suggest, these are creation and annihilation operators, and indeed you can check that they satisfy the Heisenberg commutation relations. So they commute on the delta function. Now if you plug in the expressions for, first of all, you need to invert these formulas to express U and P in terms of A and A Degger. If you do that and plug in the Hamiltonian, the result will be rather simple. And actually equivalent to the first quantized Hamiltonian, second quantized Hamiltonian that we studied yesterday. So this Hamiltonian just describes particles which are labeled by k, their wave vector. And these particles are called phonons because phonos, I think, means sound in Greek. So they are quanta of acoustic waves propagating in a crystal. Now, does it make sense to call them particles? Because, okay, we know that crystal is just a collection of atoms, and these are some sort of mathematically abstract way to describe the vibrations of atoms. But nevertheless, it's very convenient to think of a solid as a heat reservoir of phonons, so that if you consider, say, a piece of metal, it will, one can think of it as a reservoir in which we have a gas of phonons at certain temperature. And then we can apply the usual rules of statistical physics to it and say compute the heat capacity or heat conductance. And this phonon picture describes this reasonably well. So let us let me do a few calculations with this Hamiltonian. So first of all, it is possible to compute the ground state energy because, okay, so it, if you compare it to the Hamiltonian that describes free particles that we studied in the previous lecture, then it had only the first term, but not the second one. But the first one can be brought to this form if we commute these two operators using this commutation relation. So if we do that, we can write H as integral decay. So here we can write epsilon of k, which will be the energy of a phonon. And then there will be a leftover term, which is the ground state energy of phonons, and which is basically the commutator of A and A dagger. So so if you commute A K dagger, then this would give, well, delta function of zero. So you can say that the ground state energy is equal to 1/2 delta of zero and then times the integral dk over epsilon of k, where epsilon of k is the dispersion function of phonons, which is h bar cs absolute value of k. Well, this is the usual linear dispersion for sound waves, so the frequency of a sound wave is linear in the wave number, and then the energy is just h bar times the frequency. Okay, so so let's look at this formula. So it looks completely wrong, because first of all, the factor of delta of zero is infinite, and then this integral also diverges. So it seems that we made a mistake somewhere. But if you think, look more closely at this formula, it is easy to understand the origin of these divergences. So let's first look at delta of 0. So delta of x is equal to dk over 2 pi e to the akx. And this integral is equal to delta function. So now if we take x to 0 in this formula, let me change x to k here. So let this be an x. Let x be the integration variable and k be the argument of the delta function. So because this delta function that appears here is the delta function in momentum space, or in the space of wave vectors. So if you take x to 0 here, k to 0 here, on the left you get the delta function, and on the right we'll have the integral of x divided to 2 pi, which is, literally speaking, infinite. But if you imagine that this chain has finite but very large length, then this would be regularized by this length divided by 2 pi. So we see that the vacuum energy is proportional to the size of the system, which is what we expect, because the ground state energy is the extensive quantity. It should scale linearly with the volume of the system. So the physical finite quantity is the energy density. Which is 1 over 4 pi integral dk h bar cs and then absolute value of k. So now this integral also diverges. And this doesn't mean, of course, that the real crystal will have infinite ground state energy. This would be this simply doesn't make sense. The reason that we find an infinity here can be traced back to the to our starting point when we started with a discrete chain of atoms, and then we took the continuum limit when we approximated this chain by some continuous distribution of displacement field. But the real physical system was discrete, meaning that the resolution in X couldn't be larger than the lattice spacing, right? So we cannot have delta x smaller than a. So this Hamiltonian describes well phonons with sufficiently large wave numbers, or which do not oscillate, so that the acoustic waves that we can describe this way should not oscillate too fast. Otherwise, they will be sensitive to the lattice structure, about which we have forgotten during our approximation. In other words, there is a finite cutoff on at short distances below which our approximation breaks down. Now, if you translate this into the momentum space, so by uncertainty relation, delta p times delta x should be larger or equal to h bar, and then delta p is h bar delta k. So from that we find that delta k should be larger or equal 1 over smaller or equal 1 over a, right? So at wave vectors which are of order 1 over a, the approximation breaks down. So this means in for wave vectors which are of order of this value, the function, so the say the amplitude of this acoustic wave oscillates on distances of order of lattice scales, and there we should really remember that the system was discrete. Anyway, so what I'm trying to say is that this integral has a natural cutoff at momentum of order 1 over a. This means that, we cannot really calculate the ground state energy because it is sensitive, it is quadratically sensitive to the cutoff, but we can estimate that it will be proportional to h bar, cs, and then the cutoff squared, right? So the coefficient we cannot compute because we made approximations valid only at small k, and the ground state energy is dominated by modes with large k. Now this is very typical of quantum field theory. You all the time get these divergences at short distances or large wave numbers. And the best way to look at these divergences is to think that your theory is valid only up to some resolution scale. And you should really cut off all excitations below this scale, so they're not described by the field theory at hand. So here, this is manifest because we started with discrete Hamiltonian. And the cutoff is just the scale at which the lattice structure becomes important. Now, in field theories that you're going to study later in the course, they seem to be defined in such a way that they're valid at all scales. But that's not really true because one encounters same sort of divergences, and part of quantum field theory's formalism is consists of methods to treat these divergences. Anyway, let me do some computations with phonons. So the fact that we cannot really compute the ground state energy doesn't matter too much because we are not much interested in it. So what matters for physics is not the absolute normalization of energy, but the energy intervals, so the distances from the ground state energy to the energies of the excited states. And those, of course, are finite, and eigenstates of the Hamiltonian are Fock states of phonons, so we can fill in the energy levels of phonons that are labeled by their wave vectors, and each phonon has energy equal to speed of sound times the absolute value of momentum, and momentum is related to the wave vector by r, multiplying with h bar. Okay, so so from this picture of a solid as a thermal bath of phonons, one can compute, for instance, the heat capacity. So we can compute the energy the energy of phonons, or energy, internal energy of gas of phonons, we can compute from just from the Planck distribution. So I'm now jumping to the three-dimensional problem, in which case you have three types of phonons, so they have three polarizations, and their momentum is a three-dimensional vector. So since phonons are bosons, because their creation operators commute, their number density satisfies the Bose-Einstein law. So this is the probability to find. So this is an average number of phonons with momentum p. So this is the energy of phonons, and 3 takes into account the number of polarizations. So then we find the usual Stefan-Boltzmann formula. The energy will scale as the fourth power of temperature. And from that one can compute the heat capacity, which is the derivative of internal energy in temperature, which scales as the cube of temperature. Now, this is a pretty reasonable prediction for basically all materials at not so low temperatures, because at very, very low temperatures, conduction electrons are more important. But when temperature is sufficiently high, meaning higher than, say, 10 kelvins, the heat is stored mostly in phonons. And so this describes reasonably well the heat capacity of solids, but this prediction breaks down again at very high temperatures. And the reason for that is that at high temperatures, the phonons that have so higher and higher wave vectors get excited, so they have substantially large occupation numbers. And those are not described by this theory that we developed, which was sort of continuous theory that didn't take into account the latest structure. So we picture phonons as bosonic particles. So if you put, so this is just a black body distribution of bosons at temperature T. If we heat our system to temperature T, then phonons will be thermally excited from, so that their occupation numbers will satisfy the black body law. And the rest is just integration. There is a theory, which is rather old theory, This is due to Debye. Which takes into account this effects of phonons with very large momenta in certain phenomenological way. I decided to talk about it because it reminds in spirit what people usually do in quantum field theory. So, okay, we cannot describe physics at very short scales, at lattice scales, or I mean it will be very much dependent on what material we are talking about, on the crystal structure, etc., etc. But we can sort of mimic these deviations from the existence of the short distance cutoff, which we a posteriori can determine from simple physical principles. So this is the idea behind the Debye theory, which goes as follows. So integrative to infinity in this formula doesn't make physical sense, as we discussed. So here, there are no phonons with momenta larger than h bar divided by a, because the wave vector is smaller than the momenta smaller than 1 over a do not exist because of the uncertainty relationship. So p must be larger than h bar divided by delta x. Anyway, so for momenta that are of order h bar divided by the lattice spacing, this simple theory that is based on quantizing the wave equation should certainly break down. Now, the idea of Debye was very simple. So let's, I mean, this means that this dispersion relation should be very different. The density of state should change, and in a way that should be material specific and will depend on the lattice structure. But let's do a very simple-minded phenomenological approximation. So let's just cut off the integral at some particular energy and impose the condition that we don't violate the total number of degrees of freedom, so that the total number of degrees of freedom is given just by the number of atoms in the system we are studying. So the idea is that we cut off integrals, cut off momentum integral, at the cutoff. Let's introduce the cutoff energy. So introduce the maximal energy that a phonon can have, and we assume that up to this energy, the phonons behave according to this linear theory. So they have the same dispersion relation that we got by this using the continuum approximation and quantizing the wave equation. So they're described by just by the wave equation. And beyond this energy, there are simply no energy levels at all. So we simply integrate up to this maximal momentum. But then we should impose the condition that the total number of degrees of freedom is equal to three n. Okay, so each atom has 3 degrees of freedom, and if we have n atoms, so the total number of degrees of freedom should be 3n. Which mathematically we can express as so we integrate the Planck distribution, but cut off the integral at the maximum momentum. Then doing the integral, we can express the cutoff energy in terms of density and the speed of sound. These macroscopic quantities that can be easily measured. So this quantity is called the Debye energy. Or typically one uses the associated temperature called Debye temperature. Which is just, okay, it's basically the Boltzmann constant to the minus 1 times the Debye energy. So in practice, one doesn't calculate it from this formula, but just introduces this as a phenomenological constant, which is material dependent. And then, since this is the only phenomenological constant that we introduced, in a sense, by hand, by cutting off the integral, the rest we can simply compute. So in particular, we can calculate the internal energy, which will be equal to 3n k Boltzmann times t times some function of the ratio of Debye temperature to the given temperature, where d of x is given by some integral. And sometimes this is called the Debye function. So then the heat capacity can be computed by differentiating in temperature. And so it has some shape that is determined by this function. Now it's instructive to see what does it give in various limits. If the temperature is low, when it is below the Debye temperature, then of course we recover the T to the T cubed dependence that we get without the cutoff. Yes.
Where does that formula for the energy come from, the one with the D function?
So we need to compute the same integral of our Planck distribution weighted with the energy that gave T to the 4 times some Stefan-Boltzmann constant. But now we need to cut off this integral at basically at lambda. And so this is the same integral but cut off at some point. Yes?
Okay, but there's a z cubed above the line, and in the previous equation there is only a z.
Which equation?
In the equation for D.
You're talking for this equation.
Yes. Why is there a z cubed above the line?
Eight cubed. Eight.
No, he's asking about the dz times z cubed, about the density of states and momentum.
There is z cubed.
Z cubed, may I understand the English a little bit better? The z cubed comes from the d cubed p, integral over three-dimensional momentum space, which gives dp times p squared. And the last factor of z comes from the fact that you're calculating the energy, and then there is a c times p from the energy. So two factors of z from the density of states and one factor from the energy.
Okay. Sure, you consider yourself as passed the exam. So this is the explanation. So this is the formula at sufficiently low temperatures, and it is basically the same. We reproduce the T cube dependence of of the usual blackbody, the heat capacity of blackbody radiation. Now, if we go to the other extreme, namely to temperatures much larger than the Debye temperature. Then the heat capacity becomes constant and equal to 3 times the number of atoms times the Boltzmann constant, which is the heat capacity of n free atoms, which is again an understandable result. If we have an extremely high temperature, then interactions between atoms don't matter anymore. They behave as free particles. And so their heat capacity is that of just over free gases, 3n degrees of freedom. Now, the formula, the Debye formula, interpolates between these two limits and reasonably well describes the real heat capacity of solids. So if you plot it against the temperature, then it starts as T cubed, and then goes over to a constant, which is equal to 3 kV, and here it behaves as T cubed. So I went on into this discussion for the reason that we often need to introduce this cutoff and field theory. So high momenta almost always produce troubles. They all over the place will get divergent integrals. But one shouldn't be afraid of these divergent integrals because they simply signal that the theory breaks down at very short scales and has to be replaced by something more fundamental. But if we impose the reasonable consistency condition, it really doesn't matter how we get rid of this troublesome degrees of freedom, and we can get sensical results even if we introduce a very simple cutoff. So I'd like to stop here. This was really all that I was talking in these two lectures was an introduction. In the next lecture, we'll start a step-by-step main part of the course, starting with scalar field theory. Do you have any questions to this part?
Yes. When you got the energy, you need to integrate over dF from dF over dT over 2 pi h bar, and then the energy times the plus. But you have, and then you, how do you get the 3 here in front of the V?
This is the 3 polarization of a phonon. So a phonon can have 3 polarizations. So each individual phonon has 3 internal degrees of freedom. And
coming from the 3 different speeds.
Yes, in a sense. So it's when you write down the wave equation in 3 dimensions, the displacement vector has 3 components. So there are 3 independent types of waves that can propagate, and this 3 takes into account this vector. Okay, then thank you. I finish here.